Once upon a time, not so many generations ago, it was common for a landed estate to own the nearby village, a fact often reflected in the name of the local pub and, sometimes, in the uniform architecture of the buildings.
Thank you, Jeff. That was an extract from a Country Life article entitled Inside Britain's Privately Owned Villages, which leads us nicely into today's episode, which, welcome back. Welcome back to the Country House podcast. Thanks for joining us. And today, the theme of our discussion is estate villages. And an estate village is a village wholly within and part of a private estate, usually several hundred years old. They're often well known for being strongly preserved by the family that owns the estate. And as a good way to introduce us to this, Connor, this was something that you've been wanting to cover in our podcast. So I wonder if you could tell us why you wanted to talk about it and what the significance of estate villages is to you.
Yes, Ben, thank you. The estate villages, they used to be dotted across the country, and they are, as the word says, like estate villages, they are part of the country estate. So the country house is the center of the circle. It's the hub of a circle. It's a local economy. And you have the family in the country house, but you also have the families that work on the estate and in the neighboring villages. And so the country house has a responsibility over the community. And in the estates that still, in the estate villages that still exist, that is the case. Now, there's not many in existence in that, in the manner they used to be, because at the many reasons why they went into decline. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were rent controls which affected the ability to maintain properties if the rent didn't cover the cost of repair. But more so, as time developed, they weren't getting enough money to look after the properties, and so they became, in a way, a weight around the neck of the landowner. And in the years following the Second World War, they were mostly sold to sitting tenants. And these estate villages, which all many do still exist, of course, across the country, are beautiful. They have the local character. They're of local materials. These are built before the railway, before the canals. So the use of materials had to be local. And so one of the joys about driving or crossing through the English countryside is that in the space of 50 miles, you can see different architectural characters and aesthetics, simply because the local craftsmen had their way of doing things and also adhering to what was materially available at a local level. Now, there are many villages come to mind, but one is Tissington, and that is owned by Sir Richard Fitzherbert in Derbyshire. And at a time when many country houses were selling the villages, the Fitzherbert family held on to their village. And unlike many houses in previous episodes that are at the end of a long drive, Tissington is at the center of the town, and it's at the center of the community. And perhaps, Jeff, what are your thoughts on just the fact that the country house is, in a way, it is the center of the community?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Connor. I mean, apart from the fact that that they had to house these the workers on the estates and their families, thus creating the hub. Obviously, there are certain key elements of the local community that are housed in the village rather perhaps than in the grounds of the house. So you might get, for example, the village church. Sometimes the village church is attached to the house or in the gardens of the house, or sometimes the house is a private chapel. But generally speaking, on estate villages, there's always the village church where the villagers would go, and it was a place, it was at the center of the church, it was center of the village, and it's where the entire village would convene. We've talked about this in previous episodes, how church is a great leveler of estate society. So that, you know, whether you were the squire or the lord of the manor, you might have your special pew or your special box, but you're in the same building at the same time as the coal miners' sons and the farmers' sons. And it was an entire cross-section of British society would enter that church every Sunday. Likewise, you'd have other things. You'd have the village school. You know, no one, most of our listeners, I imagine, are familiar with Downton Abbey. And that estate village is not an estate village, actually. The location is Bampton in Oxfordshire, which is now just a normal village. But in Downton, it is the estate village. So you have the cottage hospital, and the local patron, the patron of the cottage hospital, who funds the cottage hospital, is Lord Grantham, who lives at Downton Abbey. So you have this, you know, like Connor said, it's a microcosm of society. You have a hospital, you have a school, you have a pub, you have a church, everything you could need, a village shop often, a post office, a bus stop, maybe a train station. Everything you need is all in the village. And actually some landlords, again, I'll caveat this by saying not all landlords were as benevolent as others. Some landlords, even when they had the capital, allowed the villages to go to rack and ruin and didn't take care of the buildings. But others took great care. I'm thinking specifically of Englefield in Berkshire. Englefield House is an extraordinary sort of Elizabethan country house that belongs to the Benyon family. And in the 19th century, Richard Fellowes Benyon rebuilt the village's houses as a model estate village. So we talk about model estate villages being estate villages that are actually built specifically for both their amenities and also their aesthetic, that it looks lovely in the context of the house. So within the village of Englefield, the Benyon family, which still owns the village, built a swimming pool for the villagers. They built a soup kitchen. They built a new school, all to help the welfare and well-being of these villages. And, you know, I guess a more contemporary example, which isn't exactly an estate village because it wasn't on their estate, but something like Bourneville, which was the Cadbury's town that they built outside the Cadbury factory near Birmingham, was a planned town to house the workers in the Cadbury factory. But again, it provided all those amenities. It had a village hall, it had a theatre, it had a, you know, sports facilities and schools and hospital, cottage hospitals and so forth. So it really is the estate village is the microcosm of what we need now on a larger scale.
You see also in places like Castle Rising with the Howards, who they set up schools as well, and they would share the cost of a headmaster's salary with the local rectory. And you know, these families who owned the estates too, they were the ones who chose who would come and lead the church. You know, they had the right to appoint the minister or whoever it was. But a really interesting part of estate villages, and for me, one of the main striking things whenever you visit them, is the aesthetic. And we were mentioning before about one of my favorite villages that I often visit, which is Downham, which has been directly passed down through the Ashton mail line since 1680, and they've owned it from the 1500s. But some things there, you walk in and there are no aerials, and I've had the pleasure of meeting Lord Ashton, the Lord of Clitheroe, a few times, and you hear about the stories of how they refused to have the electricity put in over the top, but they would create it so that it went underground, so that when you are there, it is really like stepping back in time, and there's something amazing about it. But I'm interested to hear from both of you about, yes, the what's of the aesthetics, but why the aesthetic too? Why would they want to preserve it so much?
So, Ben, just as you're saying, not having the wiring above the street and removing aerials, for example, it's long-term thinking. It is an aesthetic consideration, and the owners are invested in the village and its future and its beauty. And one characteristic of many estate villages is not only the buildings sitting comfortably together, so there seems to be an established style. Although there's great variety, they all sit comfortably together. They're not competing for attention. And you will find the colour of the estate, whether it might be yellow ochre or a shade of green, and the doors and some of the woodwork or the barge boards are painted that colour. But thinking across the country, how do estate villages differ architecturally? Well, thinking down where I am in Hampshire, you will see red brick, Flemish bond, maybe tall brick chimneys and painted barge boards on the gable end and clay tile roofs. But as you move further up the country, now into Oxfordshire, you will find rubble stone, dressed stone walls. You'll find moldings over the windows and just details that you don't find so much down in the deep south. And moving further north again, you will find rustic, well, in Scotland, they have the sort of rendered white rustic houses, which, thinking of a modern estate village in the sense of what we're talking about being the old estate villages, the Earl of Moray is building Tor na Grain on his land. And now this is with a developer, but this is an estate village. The Earl is having control, oversight over what has been built. And you can see there is a strong consideration for beauty, for aesthetic. And that is the guiding principle behind it. It is the local characteristic. The buildings that are being built there will mature gracefully and are admired by locals, and they're seen as part of the architectural character of the area. So estate villages they act as architectural points of interest wherever they are in the country as to the architectural character of that place.
Thanks, Connor. That's really helpful. And, you know, you touched again on something we keep touching on in our episodes, which is the long-term thinking of landowners. They're thinking, like we said before, in terms of centuries, not decades or years. So, Ben, going back to Downham and the fact that they put all the wiring underground, that was a long-term investment rather than a short-term one. So it would have been more expensive, but it's already paying off. For example, a number of period dramas, I can think of Born and Bred, the BBC drama from the early 2000s being one of them, was filmed there. And they may not have chosen that location had there been overhead wires that they would have had to Photoshop out or whatever. So, you know, it does pay dividends in the short and the long term, having a more aesthetic village. Of course, you know, the prettier the village, the more, you know, wealthy city dwellers might want to have a holiday home or a, you know, rent a weekend base on these estate villages. So again, it's the aesthetic appeal. It's interesting. I can think of a number of estate villages that have been voted amongst the most beautiful villages in the country. I know Clovelly in Cornwall was voted the most Instagrammable village in Britain, a beautiful fishing village that still belongs to the family who developed it. Another example I can think of is much close to London, is Shear, the church in the Surrey Hills. Sorry, not the church. The church is where Bridget Jones got married in Bridget Jones 2. It's a very pretty village. It's where they filmed The Holiday as well. For our American listeners out there, you remember Cameron Diaz coming over with her suitcase and walking down the snowy lanes. That is Shear Village in the Surrey Hills. And that, although the manor house has been sold or has been split up into flats, the Bray family of Shear still are lords of the manor of Shear, and they've lived there for 1,000 years, and they still own most of the village of Shear. And again, they preserve the beauty of the village that has made it a massive tourist destination. It's made it a huge, hugely profitable village. You know, the rents are soaring because of its proximity to London and so forth. So it's really, it does pay off in the short and the long term, having these beautiful villages. And, you know, I can think of other examples. It's amazing how quickly an economy can change. Great Chew, for example, in the Cotswolds, which is a beautiful Cotswold village, thatched Cotswold stone cottages, belongs to the Johnston family. And of course, Great Chew is well known being the home of Soho Farmhouse. And since that got on the map, everyone wants to rent cottages near Soho Farmhouse. And suddenly these estate cottages are eagerly sought after. So there are lots of reasons why estate villages, it's important to maintain their beauty. But another thing I'd like to touch on, which Connor mentioned from the architectural perspective, is there are certain quirks. One of the habits of landowners with their estate villages was to make something distinctive about their cottages and houses that they own. So for example, it may be, like, I think of the Albury estate near Shear in Surrey, which is one of the estates of the Dukes of Northumberland. They have all the Albury estate cottages have dark green painted eaves, and shutters, and door frames, and gates, and that is distinctive of the Albury estate cottages. So you can see which cottages in the village have been enfranchised by the leaseholders and bought out because they perhaps don't have the green eaves or the green front doors, whereas most of the cottages do. And again, you see the relationship between the house and the village and the architecture through small things. So it may be the village pub, which if it's owned by the family, may be named after them. So it may be, you know, the Cadogan Arms, for example, on the King's Road near where I live in Chelsea, which belongs to Lord Cadogan. It may be the Onslow Arms in Clandon, where Clandon Park is. But it also you get the architectural details sometimes from the house applied to certain properties. So again, going back to Albury, the village in Surrey, Pugin worked on Albury Park, which is the main Victorian house, which again has now been split up into flats. But the Pugin chimneys are seen in some of the houses throughout the village. So those tall Victorian twisted chimneys that Pugin was so famous for, you see that perhaps in the Dower House in the village and in various other buildings, the rectory and so forth. So there are architectural elements from the house, a bit like we touched on gate lodges the other week, or we talked about gate lodges the other week in one of our episodes, and we talked about how sometimes gate lodges were the main house in miniature at the end of the drive. And in the same way, the estate villages would have elements of the house incorporated into them.
Yeah, you see similar in Ripley, another one of my favorite privately owned villages, where they redesigned the whole village to be Alsatian style, wanting it to be something very different for visitors to come. And it really is impressive. And they created a French style hotel to go along with it. But sort of turning path a little bit and not wanting to appear earnest, we talk about the long-term thinking, but I'm also wondering, was there something else, you know, different motives going along with this? For example, the term sort of was brought into legislation of closed villages in 1834. And at the time, it was essentially understood to be a term that allowed privately owned villages to reduce their poor rates and reduce the financial burden of the local parish to poor people by not allowing poor immigrants to have to claim settlement, you know, with their rights there. And by beautifying the houses that were on the village, it would allow and entice the better workers to come. And also, it was sometimes known in these villages that they would have a beautiful facade, but then it would be a very damp, not very nice interior and back of the house too. So you look at all of these other aspects, and Sandringham and Horton followed suit with redesigning their villages to sort of have this appearance. And then you look at the normal village life in open villages, and it was very dirty. It was very, very densely populated. And so you have these two sort of different things going on. And I'm wondering what are the transparent ulterior motives might have been going on with the creation of an estate village?
I wouldn't say it was ulterior, but touching on what you'd mentioned, that the face of these villages are so handsome and there's a lot of care put into the aesthetic of the houses, that the estate village is an extension of the country house. It is the county. It is that part of the county putting its best foot forward. And it's a point of pride, not only for the village, but for the family who are responsible for the village and responsible for the community life there. And that ethos still exists in the villages that operate in this way. Thinking of how they work as a village aesthetically, you are driving down a country lane and there's hedges either side of the road. It's winding. You're coming down a hill into a nestled valley of old oak and chestnut and beech, and all of a sudden there's small houses that rise into different shape houses, a variety of sizes. You've big and small, all beside each other. And then it opens into a square that might have a war memorial. And all around are handsome houses that today people, there's a popular pub perhaps on the green, and people love to go there in the summer, get their photograph with these houses. And at the top of the town, perhaps there is the gate to the country house, or in the case of Tissington, the house is at the center of the town. This is a way of thinking of the beauty of the town. It is, of course, a way of showing off the status of the prosperity of the estate, that it can afford to have such lovely houses. And the front of a house will always be more handsome than the side and the rear, because it is what faces the public, and less expensive materials and less skilled labor will be put into the non-viewed faces of the building. But an estate village is dense. It's dense in the sense that it's a collection of houses, perhaps with a green or a square at the center, and surrounded by countryside. So it's not spread out. And in terms of the long-term thinking, which Jeff was talking about, it's not just an architectural decision. It's not just aesthetic. It's also community. So thinking back to Tissington, I know that Sir Richard Fitzherbert has said that a lot of the decisions they make there, as he's responsible for the village and village life, are not commercial. And rents are 20% and 80% of the market rate. And long-standing staff will have the best terms, of course. And he said he would much rather rent for a lower rent to someone who participates in the community than seek the top rent by someone who doesn't get involved. And so you can see that the choice, in a way, of tenant and having families that are, you've many of these estates where families have been there, just like the family in the big house, have been there for centuries too. So they have a rooted connection with the place. And it's a no-brainer to make a beautiful village, because, of course, beauty is attractive. It sells. And I suppose developers are seeing that more now. Things that were built post-war compared to today, the direction is going back to beauty. When I think of Poundbury, Torne na Grain, Knock Roon, which started, Nansleiden, the direction is going back to beauty, and it's in fact been led by estate villages. One of the biggest, perhaps, estate villages of modern times, which is Poundbury, which is not connected to a country house in the way we're talking about, but it is built by the Duchy of Cornwall. So the ethos behind its aesthetic is similar. It is long-term thinking, and it has covenants. You can't just put aerials on the roof. There is a sense of an aesthetic consideration for all houses.
Thanks, Connor. Connor, that's really helpful. Great that you touched, or you talked about Poundbury and Nansleiden, amongst others, the Duchy of Cornwall's projects. I think I've probably got, I'll sort of come against you a little bit on the romanticism of estate villages that you've talked about, because you're absolutely right that retrospectively we can see how great they are. But I think Ben was also right in the sense of when they were built, they often were quite selfish. The Lord of the Manor wanted a pretty village that his guests would pass through en route to the gates to come up to the main house. And so, yes, often it was just about the aesthetic facades, for the sake of impressing his visitors, and the houses often were falling down behind, and if it wasn't a benevolent landowner, he wouldn't be investing in rebuilding them. Often he just invested in what you see in the front. We talked last week or the week before, a couple of weeks ago, about, you know, houses where they had different wood flooring in different rooms, and sometimes they would continue the wood through the door to make it look like it extended into the servants' quarters, and then they'd suddenly change to cheaper pine or whatever. From teak or oak. So there was a constant, amongst perhaps more pompous or aesthetically driven landowners, there often was just an aesthetic appeal. But at the same time, to counter that, you know, estate villages, in estate villages, we saw the earliest form of social housing. We saw almshouses built by lords of the manor, which would house the very poorest in society and would give them an allowance. You know, so I think of my local almshouse is the Royal Hospital Chelsea, which was built by Charles I or Charles II, I can't remember, one of the Charleses, in the early 17th century. And it was to house the Chelsea pensioners former soldiers who had served for a long time in the armed forces and who had no money and no family to support them. And that goes on today. And I see Chelsea pensioners walking up and down the King's Road in their red tunics. So almshouses are a really important part of estate life. But again, coming back and talking a little more about sometimes the more selfish reasons for estate villages, there are stories of the reason why estate villages were built was because the whole village was moved because of the aesthetic appeal of the village not being in the sight line of the house. So I can think, the best example I can think of is Milton Abbey in Dorset, which was the Damer family, the Earls of Dorchester, who I think it was Joseph Damer, the first Earl of Dorchester, found the local town of Milton disturbing his vision of rural peace. So he commissioned Capability Brown and William Chambers to design a new village, Milton Abbas, in a wooded village to the southeast of the abbey, where the entire village was relocated, so that the previous village could be demolished and the site landscaped, so that he had this wonderful, beautiful Capability Brown parkland with no houses on it. And admittedly, that now the village of Milton Abbas is a very sought after village. It's got 36 identical thatched cottages. Again, it has almshouses and a baker, a blacksmith, a brewery originally, a public house, a doctor's surgery, and a chapel. So all the things you expect from a state village, but ultimately it came from the selfish motives of Lord Dorchester, who didn't want the village spoiling his view. So there are, like all these things, there is good and bad in the motives, but the point is, and Connie, you really brought this home, I think, the point is that ultimately these estate villages have proven to be some of the most sought after villages in the country, both to live in, to visit, and to film in. So, and it really is interesting. There aren't many privately owned villages left. So many of them were broken up piecemeal after the Second World War. But you can tell when you're driving through the countryside, if you come to a really beautiful village, it's almost guaranteed to be privately owned still. But secondly, you'll probably find some grand gates and a lovely house at the end of the drive.
Yeah, it's. I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Jeff. You could say it was the oldest form of slight virtue signaling, in that it was probably quite trendy to appear as though you were helping the poor as much as you can by presenting the most beautiful cottages in the village. People would think, "Gosh, that family is so generous, aren't they?" But then they were really sought after, and you do have all the almshouses. I currently live in a formerly privately owned village, quite recently no longer privately owned, and we have stunning almshouses. They really are beautiful, and the house I'm in, it's made wonderfully, and we have the great pub basically two doors down, and it's stunning and well preserved, and so you have to give credit as well. And I wonder, what are the threats to these villages today, the ones that actually do last, and how are they still surviving?
I think there are how are they surviving? They've had to diversify. So we've talked about filming in villages. We've talked about renting out some of the houses and cottages to perhaps city dwellers who will pay more rent for a weekend base and so forth. I think it's a really fine line with landowners who still own villages to commercialize the village whilst at the same time maintaining its integrity and its history. So Connor mentioned that a lot of landowners do give subsidized rent to families who have lived and worked on the land for generations. And we know that's the case in some of the estate villages at Beaver Castle. Emma Rutland talked about it. I know of a number of estate villages where they prioritize giving people with local links to the estate subsidized rent. But at the same time, they do have to commercialize. And, you know, there are so many ways of doing that. I mean, it might be, like I say, renovating beautifully. It might be holiday lets. It's really sad that a lot of old tenants have been kicked out because it's more commercially viable for estates to rent these cottages out on Airbnb or through luxury property rental companies. But also, you know, there are other things, creation of farm shops. I think the best example I think of there, apart from Dalesford, which is a wonderful estate that belongs to the Bamfords of JCB fame, who have bought up most of the surrounding villages surrounding Dalesford House. They have their big farm shop, which is now synonymous with the estate, and there are Dalesford branches all over London and the southeast. And you know, that's an example of a family who've only owned the estate for, I think, less than 50 years, but have really invested in the estate. But a lot of, you know, they've turned their pubs into gastro pubs, they've turned their cottages into holiday cottages and so forth. But I'd also just, before I go, we can't not mention in this episode the village of Ensor, which is the estate village, the model village on the Chatsworth estate, because that really is still an estate village of the old school. Almost all of the villagers who live there work on the estate. Deborah Devonshire, the late Dowager Duchess of Devonshire, moved to her dower house, which I believe was the old rectory in Ensor, for the last few years of her life when she left Chatsworth. And that's the other thing to remember is, of course, most of these villagers did have a dower house. You think about in Downton Abbey, where the Dowager Countess of Grantham lived in the village, in the second nicest house in the village, which was the dower house. And it was, in many ways, again, it was the early form of housing for old people. You know, it was located in a place where she could walk to the local shop and walk to the local hospital and walk to the local, rather than having to get a carriage or get a car. So there are a lot of the estate village did pioneer a lot of things that we see in broader society, from almshouses and hospitals and schools. But they really have had to diversify in recent years, Ben. And you know, Ensor also has a farm shop, a well known farm shop. And the National Trust, of course, we've talked about this before, but has gone right the other way and sadly have turfed out most of the tenants who have been there for generations and turned most of their properties into commercial holiday lets. And again, that's sad, but it's where the trust is not necessarily prioritizing earning money over maintaining the integrity and history of the estate. What are your thoughts, Connor?
I was going, well, with Ensor, continuing thought of long-term thinking, that when you build, as these villages show, when you build beautiful and use natural local materials, what you do matures gracefully and lasts for many generations, because beauty speaks from generation to generation. If you build something that's unattractive, the next generation, as soon as it shows signs of disrepair, will be more readily thinking of demolishing it rather than restoring it. And it's beauty that says to the next generation to restore and to renovate. And that's why these villages, and well, it's one of the main reasons, I think, that these villages have not changed, but have rather grown organically over time, is that those which started out the village thought of beauty in their design. And when they use stone walls, they have sash windows, they have arched doors with fan lights, they have cornices or projecting eaves with a slate or clay tile roof and tall chimneys. These are the houses that, when people have a picture postcard image of England, it's these estate villages with the church and the green and the old trees. And it's rooted, it's nestled, and it looks as though it's always been there. And this brings me back to architecture and the landscape, which is, when people talk of unspoilt landscape, they don't mean a landscape without buildings. It's a landscape without ugly buildings. And we can, looking to the future, look to the past and how these villages were developed. And if you are building locally close to these villages or in these villages, the architectural character, the materials, the pattern book to what to build, how to do it right, is there. And like you were saying that, Ben, many of these houses have a handsome face, but maybe deteriorating behind. The handsome face is what you want to bring forward, but you will improve the inside, make it comfortable. And these estate villages have, from where we are today, have a bright future, at least in terms of their attraction of tourists and people who always want to visit them throughout the year. And back to what Jeff said about Clovelly, that I believe they have 150,000 tourist visitors a year, which means that the village does in fact turn a profit.
That's fantastic. And you can't help but see as well, recently I visited Swinton Park Estate in Massam, another beautiful privately owned place. And it's just wonderful. I was there and we were walking around, and they've done a fantastic job, Lord and Lady Massam, of diversifying to continue their traditions. And I spoke to a family. The family ran, the mother and daughter ran the Bird of Prey Centre there, and they put on experiences and stuff. And this is really common there in the gardens, in other parts, archery, fishing, all of these families. And that particular family had lived on the estate for generations. And it was a wonderful experience. And I think perhaps a good note to finish on for this episode is a touch of hope. With that, we thank you for joining us for episode 10 of the Country House podcast. And thank you for your support. And if you are still knocking around, if you wouldn't mind leaving us a rating and a review wherever you listen to us, that would be fantastic. But thank you and goodbye.